Unceded Airwaves by the Indigenous Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. Unceded Airwaves is broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded, and current lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today's show intro was OCM by Susan the Glue Clark. Unceded Airwaves broadcast every week from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories and Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Autumn Schnell-Vilji, actually, Vanguizi. Autumn Schnell-Vilji, Chief Doon Cooey, Janet Cooey, Jacqueline Cooey, Vivian Cooey, Shay Deji. I am Treaty 11 Gwich'in and a Nuvialuit on my mother's side. I was born and raised in Amaskwachi, Wiskayagan, on Treaty 6 territory of the Cree, Métis, Nakota Sioux, and Soto peoples. And I would like to acknowledge that I was an uninvited guest there for the first 17 years of my life. I feel really grateful. I grew up there, and that land means a lot to me. I think I just have a special connection because I grew up there. But now I'm living here on the unceded ancestral and traditional lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations, and I'm really grateful to be here as well. I've been here for my entire first year, and I feel really grateful to be an uninvited guest on Unceded Coast Salish lands, and I'm really grateful to be here.
Yes, my name is Ben Chung. I'm Jewish and Korean, and grew up mostly as also an uninvited guest on the Shawnee territory, United States, and I too am an uninvited guest here, and very grateful to be on Coast Salish territory.
Beautiful. So we would like to thank our sponsors, Decolonizing Water and NORAD Electric. You're listening to Season 3, Episode 20. Ooh. We made it to 20 episodes. I don't know how that happened, but we done it. Of Unceded Airwaves, today we'll be talking about Indigenous feminisms. This is a very, very special topic to me because I would say probably around a year ago, actually, I had a male teacher of mine tell me that Indigenous feminism didn't exist, and it kind of shook me to my core. I didn't really understand what feminism meant. I googled what the definition of feminism is, which I'm doing right now for you all, and feminism is defined as the advocacy of women's rights on the basis of equality of the sexes. And to me, that definition didn't feel like enough. It didn't feel nuanced enough. It didn't really have what I wanted to mean in it. So I kind of did my own personal research, and the first interview that you're going to be listening to is Crystal Fraser, and she was somebody who I first contacted because I wanted to know what Indigenous feminism meant, and I knew that she identified as a feminist. So you're going to hear what she said, and it really kind of changed the way I saw feminism and indigeneity and the interaction of both. And then the next interview that we have is with Dori Nason. So Dori Nason talks about feminism in terms of her experience as well as literature. Both of the interviews kind of talk about what feminism means to them, how their studies include and revolve around feminism, why Indigenous feminism is so important and such a big issue. And actually, I'm making a radio documentary about this for the Indigenous Radio Doc series.
Ooh. Self-plugging.
We're going to listen to it on the show when it's done. It's basically just like this episode, but way better edited. There's like music and transitions, things like that. You're going to hear it. And so, yeah, stay tuned into CITR. And learn what made me interested in Indigenous feminisms. Yeah, but before we get into it, let's set our intention for the day. So we are the Indigenous Radio Collective. Every week we discuss Indigenous issues, current events, and entertainment. We are a collective of Indigenous and non-Indigenous students who use our weekly airtime for our own self-representation.
Our goal, we strive to center Indigenous voices on our show and to build narratives that empower Indigenous peoples. Unceded Airwaves is our opportunity to share and define the diversity of our cultures and highlight some influential Indigenous people, too.
So if you can relate to the goals of the show and are wondering how to get involved, please reach out. You can reach us on our social media. We have Facebook and Twitter. And if you have a voice for decolonization, we want to hear from you.
Everyone is welcome, and there is no experience necessary. Our weekly meeting is every Wednesday at 1 p.m. at CITR in the lower level of the Nest. If you want to get involved but don't want to be on air, there are plenty of other ways to participate in this collective as well.
You can follow Unceded Airwaves on Facebook and Twitter. If you're aware of a great Indigenous artist, send us a tweet using the hashtag UncededMusic or send us a Facebook message at Unceded Airwaves, and we will do our best to get it on air. And if we play a song you send us, we will even give you a shout out.
We are always looking to hear from our listeners about what you're up to, too. So let us know about any Indigenous artists that you're into right now and what events you're attending or promoting. As always, we'll post a link to the podcast of this episode after the show. We'll have our weekly
So the first song is going to be by Silver Jackson. I was going to do another Indigenous FemCon playlist, but then I decided that, like, basically all my playlists are Indigenous FemCon because women are great. So enjoy Silver Jackson. Ooh. You just heard We Dressed in Our Own Love by Silver Jackson. So for the first part of the show, Actually, first of all, back up, Autumn. You're listening to Unseated Airwaves. The time is 2:12 p.m. Yeah, and now we have an extra special treat for you all. We will be listening to an interview that I did with Crystal Fraser several months ago. I want to say around 9 months ago. Yeah, Crystal is a fellow Gwich'in band member, ooh, although she is Gwich'ia Gwich'in and I am Tetlit Gwich'in, so we are different. Right.
I'm sure there's lots of history there, but I'll just go with it, yeah.
I think the main difference is that there are just different language dialects.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's also Vuntuk Gwich'in, too, and mm-hmm. Vuntuk Gwich'in is primarily in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And if any of you have heard of Janine Frailty, I don't know how to pronounce her last name, but she is Vuntuk mm-hmm. Gwich'in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, anyways, random Gwich'in facts by Autumn.
Good. Always appreciated.
It's also Crystal Fraser's birthday today, so... tell her how much you love her and that she's great. And if you don't know her, tell her that Autumn loves her and that you should probably love her too. Because, again, she's great. You'll love with her after this interview. I'm 100% sure. This is a very special interview because it was one of the first ones that I actually did. And I did it through CJSR back in Amaskwatchewaskaigan on my Treaty 6 birth land. It also really affected me personally and why residential schools are a feminist issue, because that wasn't something that I had thought about, even though it makes a lot of sense now that I have listened to what she says. But anyways, enough of me talking about what Crystal says and time for you to listen to what she says. So enjoy the interview.
Dringwinzi, my name is Crystal Fraser. I am Gwich'ia Gwich'in, originally from Inuvik and Tree River in the Northwest Territories.
Great. So tell me a little bit about yourself. Let's get to know each other.
Well, at the University of Alberta here, I am a PhD candidate in the Department of History and Classics. And my research is focused on the history of residential schools in Inuvik, Northwest Territories, between the years of 1959 and when the last residential school closed there, Grolier Hall, in 1996. And this is kind of a family history for me. I've had some family members who went to residential schools and have also felt the intergenerational effects of that.
So now, getting to tell you a little bit more, what does Indigenous feminism mean to you?
Wow. Well, I could talk about feminism all day. Indigenous feminism actually has a lot of meanings. I think back to our history as Gwich'in people. We had very strong women who led our communities as political leaders. Also, our societies were pretty flexible as far as gender and sexuality went. We were a matrilineal society. Mm-hmm. Lots of cases of women having several husbands and vice versa. Very flexible social rules. But for being an Indigenous feminist today, I think that we have to try and unpack it more, add a little bit more nuance. So even though in Indigenous cultures, you know, we do want to make ample space for fluid relations and two-spirited people, we also have to understand that a lot of things are intersectional. So the way that we think about race and class and gender and ableism, yeah. In order to be a good feminist, so to say,
yeah.
I think that we have to be supportive of all those things.
Okay, that's really cool. And what are some acts that you personally do that you would say make you an Indigenous feminist?
Yeah, well, I don't know about you, but, you know, I just kind of think being an Indigenous woman today in the 21st century,
yeah.
You know, living in Canada, that's kind of like a political act in itself.
Oh, yeah.
Because as we're going through, you know, Canada's 150th birthday, and we're seeing all kinds of celebrations that actually cost, you know, an incredible amount of money.
Yeah.
We still have various challenges in front of us. Clean drinking water on reserves.
Yep.
you know, about 60% of Indigenous women are victims of sexual assault.
Yep. Or even like the missing sisters.
Yes. So, I mean, right now we're seeing this inquiry start to unravel. So I think that as long as we can give people gentle reminders, if we can interrupt hegemonic narratives that are really meant to marginalize us.
Yeah.
I kind of see those as everyday acts of feminism and resistance. Yeah.
That's great. How are residential schools a feminist issue?
I mean, for sure, residential schools are a feminist issue. Like, one of the things that I think about feminism is that we really want everyone to be treated according to what they deserve, right? Like, I mean, when I talk about intersectional feminism, race is certainly one of those factors.
Yes.
And I mean, one interesting thing actually about Grolier and Stringer Hall is that even though they were residential schools, there were a few white children who resided there. That being said, they would have also been affected by hostile policies.
Yes.
However, the whole system was not designed for their elimination. So, I mean, if you think about how the Canadian nation state was constructed and then expanded into the North, Indigenous women have kind of always centrally been one of the main threats. They were kind of, you know, constructed as bad mothers, unable to look after their children. And then you get other social factors into the mix, like alcohol, you know,
that really didn't exist before.
Exactly. All kinds of new factors that we were expected to cope with. And especially in Inuvik, it was this grand plan of trying to move families off the land and into town. And for the first time ever, you have a liquor store that I'll say is owned by the territorial government. And so that caused a lot of problems. And I mean, I think one of the unique aspects about the Northwest Territories is, you know, the last school closed like 20 years ago, 21 years ago.
Which is not that long ago.
No. And it's still... it's still pretty fresh.
Yeah.
It's still pretty fresh up there. On the other hand, there's a ton of like language revitalization programs, on the land programs. I mean, I think the other aspect that certainly would come into play for feminists is that former residential school students and survivors and their families are still coping with a lot of trauma. And a lot of that trauma we are now seeing with social services and the removal of children from their families. Certainly, Cindy Blackstock and others have suggested that this is a new form of obviously removing children from their families.
How does your research tie in or tie into and consider feminism?
Well, that's a really interesting question because I've been interested in feminism for a long time, probably about 10 years. And actually, as I was preparing for this interview, I thought, I need to reflect on like when and how I became a feminist. And I really can't put my finger on it. But I remember being like 12 years old and saying, I'm not going to change my last name when I get married. So that was kind of like my first feminist outburst,
That's
I think.
So funny. I did the same thing when I was 12.
So, I mean... as I went through my BA and then my Master's of Arts, like, I always wanted to take, like, a feminist approach and include gender studies. And I'm actually working on one chapter right now that looks at Indigenous bodies at Grolier and Stringer Hall. So, like, how bodies were kind of wrapped up in the colonial framework of assimilation. And specifically about women, like, these are residential schools that were open throughout the 1960s, the 1970s, so not that long ago. And women at these institutions had to have forced monthly pelvic examinations. There was at Grolier Hall a giant chart on the wall that tracked everyone's menstrual cycle, like for everyone to see. Of course, you had to ask for pads. You weren't even allowed to use tampons. So very.
I wonder why all of those arbitrary rules were enforced.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it was for. You know, basically the federal government and colonizers to, you know, gain control over someone that they thought was pretty dangerous, Indigenous women, right?
True. I guess we were so powerful.
We were threatening their project of expanding the Canadian nation state. So, some very interesting material. Lots of programs like around venereal disease.
Really?
And then, of course, in my research, I get into, you know, sexual assaults and stuff like that that happen both at the residential school, but then also just more broadly in Inuvik.
Okay. I know, like, in the South, we hear about, because it was a boarding school, there were really high sexual assault rates. Is it the same in Inuvik?
I would say even more so.
Really? Okay.
Because Grolier Hall had close to 400 cases.
Really?
That were brought forward in the early 1990s.
Okay.
And the RCMP basically interviewed everyone.
Yeah.
And then whittled it down to 23.
Okay, so they...
Because they really felt that those 23 cases could win in court.
Okay. Did they end up getting to the court phase?
They did, yes.
Okay,
and
most
like,
of them win?
Probably half a dozen people have been charged and sent to prison. But there was also a Grolier Hall legal case.
Yeah.
And that was negotiated with... the Roman Catholic Church, but also the Canadian government. And that Grolier Hall case actually set the framework for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
It is.
I would have never guessed that. What motivated you to get started with your research?
You know, I kind of have this long story that I will shorten for our purposes. but I basically came to university at kind of a late age. You know, I didn't really finish high school till I was 23 or 24.
Yeah.
And I just came to university with a blank slate and wanting a new start. And actually found a really great mentor in history. I started out in political science.
Yeah.
And took a history course and found a great mentor in history. And I just thought, well, let's give this a shot.
Yeah.
As I wrote my MA thesis, you know, I knew that as someone from the North, as someone who is Gwich'in, that I just really felt like I had a contribution that I could make.
Okay.
And so I mean, like, it's all kind of about reciprocal relationships and about giving back.
Yeah.
And, you know, as someone who is Gwich'in living in the Edmonton area, you know, I can't practice my culture every single day.
Yeah.
There are things I can do, but I can't do everything.
It's hard to be active in a community that you don't live in.
Exactly. So I kind of feel like that I make my own contribution back to our culture through my research.
What were some findings that stood out to you right off the bat when you were starting your master's thesis or starting your PhD thesis?
I'm not really sure that there were many surprises because like I grew up in Inuvik and I had a good understanding of the local history. But one thing that was really great is that I went up north and I did about 60 interviews with people.
Okay.
And that was such an honor and a special time. And I mean, the hospitality in the north is always like awesome.
Yeah.
And people are just so supportive. I mean, I guess maybe that kind of surprised me is that, you know, I knew people knew what I was doing, but they were willing to go out of their way and talk to me, give rides, give meals, like kind
That's
of
lovely.
Like, it was really wonderful.
That's great. So it was more of like the experience aspect.
Yeah, the experience of being a researcher and going home to start your project.
Also, what was your master's thesis in?
My master's thesis looked at fur trade journals.
Okay.
So I looked at like the Journal of Alexander Mackenzie.
Yeah.
He was the first one to arrive among the Gwich'in.
Okay. I guess Mackenzie Delta makes sense.
Yeah. And John Franklin and a missionary named James Hunter.
Okay.
And so what I did was I took these journals and I didn't even have to go to the archives.
Yeah.
They're just at the library. And I looked at the ways in which they talked about Indigenous women in the North.
Okay.
So it was more about representations, like who these women were through their own lenses, like of the explorers and fur traders. And one thing I found, like, especially with Alexander Mackenzie's journals, is that he didn't write them till like nine years later.
Oh, really?
When he was already back home in Britain.
Okay.
So I'm not sure how much you can remember about Indigenous women 9 years later.
Yeah.
And of course, like the editorial processes and stuff that they go through. So I concluded that what we actually get is a snapshot of what a white British dude thought about women. Yeah.
Okay. That's funny. Now, turning this onto another page, what were some pre-colonial constructs of womanhood?
Like, of course, I know about Gwich'in Bess.
Yes.
And we have a number of historical accounts and stories and legends about women.
Yeah.
So specifically, we have practices around our moon time and menstruating.
Okay.
And we hold like a certain kind of power once we start to do that.
Yes.
And there's actually a pretty famous story of a little girl who was walking down the beach, and she was wearing a hood so she wouldn't look at her father or her brother as they went off on their hunt. And she accidentally did, and they turned to stone.
Okay.
So very powerful representation of what we can do, I suppose.
Yeah, shows our strength. How did residential schools affect this conception of womanhood?
Residential schools and Christianity and colonialism kind of all go together.
Yeah.
So, you know, when our ancestors converted to Christianity, you know, about a century ago, all kinds of conceptions like around polygamy, all of that would have been no longer okay, like to have several husbands or wives. Mm-hmm. Also more of a patriarchal kind of
society.
Like social relations would have emerged from that.
Yes.
And I mean, I think just in general, the like the partnership among families also would have changed.
Okay.
Because now you have families who are going into so-called organized communities for like Christmas and Easter.
Okay.
And like certain hunting and trapping periods would kind of be planned around that.
Okay.
Yeah. So those are just a couple examples.
So it just changed like kind of how the family existed?
Yes.
Did you say? Yeah.
Okay. I would say for sure. One thing that's really interesting is that the Northwest Territories had a program called the Home Management Program.
Yep.
So once women graduated high school, they got out of residential school, Grolier, Stringer Hall.
Yep.
And then they went into the home. Maybe they wanted to start a family. Maybe they found their sweetheart at their residential school.
Yeah.
And they moved in together. It totally happened.
Yeah.
And actually, teenagers also got married and had children at quite an early age when maybe they weren't ready to as a way to escape the residential school.
Yeah.
But anyway, they had this home management program that if these women, these Gwich'in and Uvalowit, like northern Indigenous women, if the residential schooling hadn't worked effectively, that's okay because we have home management and we're now going to come into your homes and tell you how to be a good mother.
Oh, no.
And tell you how to cook.
Okay.
And tell you how to clean and tell you how to service your husband.
Wow.
That's
so kind of them.
That was like well into the late 1970s.
That's insane.
Yes.
It happened that late.
It did.
Wow.
They were also taught to be straight.
Okay.
You know, so no two-spiritedness, you know, LGBTQ, none of that would have been tolerated. you know, meanwhile, a lot of these kids are being traumatized and assaulted. So not really learning what a healthy, intimate relationship is in the first place.
Yeah. About the two-spirited thing, was that like, so I know that it's like really popular amongst plenty of Indigenous cultures because we're just very welcoming. But like more specifically, the gender binaries that like surround it. So like girls having to wear skirts and boys having to like cover up their tattoos. Did that change before and after residential schools?
Yeah, I think it did. Like specifically for the Gwich'in, and this is probably noteworthy, is that I've never read anywhere for us to refer to people as two-spirit.
Okay.
So I think that that's maybe like a pan-Indigenous word that is kind of applied to us.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what it would have been called for Gwich'in. Like, I think flexibility was just kind of worked into our culture.
Yeah.
And that way it would have been so normalized that maybe we wouldn't have really called it anything.
They would have just been people to us instead of people who have to
do it.
Identify as a certain way.
Exactly.
Okay.
I think really with the introduction of Christian society and missionaries, like specifically in our region, that would have been about the 1870s, 1880s.
Yeah.
You know, you see women like my grandmother, Marka Bullock.
Yeah.
Now wearing a headscarf.
Yes.
Wearing long dresses.
Okay.
Dressing pretty modestly. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you go back and look at early like artistic renditions of Gwich'in women, we weren't dressed that way.
How were we dressed?
Mostly in skins and hides and stuff like that. But there wasn't really anything especially modest about it. We didn't have to wear head coverings.
Yeah.
We had these gorgeous facial tattoos, which I totally want to get one day. certainly in our own region, I kind of see this resurgence of womanhood happening right now. For instance, like, we elected the first president of the Gwich'in Tribal Council, who is a woman. That was really awesome. We have all kinds of leaders, especially in education. You know, Velma Lisiak, she's the principal of the school in Iqaluit.
Okay.
We have an education superintendent in Inuvik who's Gwich'in. You know, Alistine Andre, who is retiring this fall. She's an anthropologist with the Gwich'in Tribal Council. And so I really see, like, all of these great things happening. However, I do still see, like, some women feeling that maybe the home is still kind of their place to be. I would say, I'm using air quotes here, like traditional gender roles.
Yeah.
But those are like traditional white people gender roles.
Yes.
Right? For the woman to stay home and cook and clean.
Yep.
So when I say traditional here, I'm not referring to like our
indigenous traditions.
That's right.
So what were traditional expressions? Not, I guess not expressions. Like, what were the traditional gender roles in indigenous societies?
Well, from all of the reading that I've been doing, they call it a partnership.
Okay.
So, I mean, as I mentioned, you might have a family with, like, several wives or several husbands.
Yes.
Many, many children, lots of children.
We love children.
And basically what would happen is when you're traveling out on the land, especially in the winter, when you're traveling by dog team, when you're packing a sled, you would travel with other families in in groups into the mountains in order to find the caribou and stuff. There's a great document called The Cope Stories. And these were interviews that a lot of our family members undertook throughout the 1970s and 80s. And those memories are kind of cataloged in there. But yeah, I would say it was a partnership that it was, you know, egalitarian. Of course, men had certain jobs, women had certain jobs.
Yeah. It wasn't like super strict, like only women could put the berries in the. It was very fluid.
It was very fluid and free. And I mean, once we start to get into the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, where you know, we're learning the ways of Unjit, of white people. Yeah. That, you know, kind of these gender confines are being placed over us. But you talk to a lot of people, and some of them were lucky to stay home from residential school.
And
I have a cousin, for instance, he stayed home. And his siblings were off at school. And he was a boy, but because he was the only child at home, he learned how to sew. He learned how to bake. He learned how to bead. He delivered babies, right? So you kind of just step in wherever you're needed. However, I will say that, like, when we do talk about our own cultures, it especially in the context of colonization, we also need to be aware that, you know, historically we weren't perfect.
Well, thank you so much, Crystal. This has been great.
Yeah.
Lovely learning about Indigenous feminism and residential schools and how they all tie in together.
Masi Cho, thank you so much for inviting me.
The distance between Zigwan and Minokuma is the difference between singing and not singing. Broad leaves are born. We relearn fragile green. Waves of wind, light harvested into food. Sun making breath. River washing land. Lake suffocating ice, trees bleeding sweet. I've only ever seen you hitchhiking into dreams or running from the headlights. But today, here you are, just sleeping, sitting, eating. Hours of still, armfuls of nothing. And Bapase, fearless forest pilot, fast navigating, surgical maneuvering, unfolding red for the future, black for the past, white for the exactly right now. And you, with your fortress of nice, trying to find something real, hiding in poetics, singing in hieroglyphics, moving around my flesh in semiotics, but never reaching out. This distance is longer than all of our lives. We go, but different bodies return. If they return at all.
CITR and Discorder are hiring a new station manager. Just asking for a friend, but if I know someone who would be great for this position, how would they apply? Well, you can email Eleanor at volunteer@citr.ca or Hala at president@citr.ca if you have any questions, and the full job description is on the CITR and Discorder website. If your friend thinks they can handle all this, then they should send a resume and cover letter to Hala Bertrand at president@citr.ca by Friday, March 3rd. Of CITR and Discorder, but are you a true friend?
Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 for discounts on Commercial Drive at
Audio Pile,
High Life Records, Mintage, People's Co-op Bookstore, Stormcrow Tavern, The Rio Theater, JQ Clothing Limited, and Bone Rattle Music Limited.
You're listening to Unseated Airwaves. The time is 2:41 p.m. and the song you just heard was, which song was it by Leanne Simpson? It was Spacing by Leanne Simpson. Before that, you heard my interview with Crystal Fraser, again, whose birthday is today. Tell her you love her. She is wonderful. But now we're going to have an interview with Dori Nason talking about Indigenous feminisms from her perspective, feminism in literature, and general tips for all of you. Content warning, sass, don't stop listening. It's really important to talk about. Here's my interview with Dori.
My name is Dori Nason. I'm a professor in First Nation Studies and the Department of English. My pronouns are she and her. And how else would I? I'm an Indigenous feminist, a scholar, a writer, and mostly I think about myself as an Anishinaabe woman and also a Chicana woman.
Beautiful. And then can you tell us about the beginning of your feminist journey?
My feminist origins?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. Actually, I've talked about this before in different talks that I've given about Indigenous feminism, and for me, it's always been really important not to assume that what people do in terms of their activism and their, you know, their work around sexism or anti-race work has to be under this feminist umbrella. So I'm really careful about, my feminist origins are specific to my experience and where I came from. And so growing up in the States, I was exposed to, well, obviously, lots of different things in the States around racism and sexism. But in terms of my upbringing and reading and training as a student, I was really drawn to Chicana feminists and women of color feminists. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of people talking about Native feminism, was what they would say in the States. And so I really was seeking that out once I got to my PhD program. So my origins are more kind of thinking about women of color activism and feminism in the States.
Okay.
And my experience around that as a, not only as a young Native woman, but as a young Mexican woman. So
did you start, were you a feminist or would you consider yourself a feminist when you were younger? Like I remember my feminist origins was when I was 12 and I was yeah, equality.
I think I always had, my mom tells this story about me being 5 years old in the car and telling her that, one, that I was going to be a professor, which I don't know how I heard of that.
Predicted.
I know. I don't know how I came up with that. And that also that I found it really unfair that the way that girls were treated in the world. And, I was never going to get married or change my name or do anything like that. And she was like, where is she getting all this stuff? So I think it was always, kind of, I don't know where that came from, but I do know as a I had lots of strong women in my family. I think a lot of people say that I witnessed their mistreatment and the things that happened to them within family dynamics. And I think that was my justice orientation was to want to deal with, quite frankly, intimate violence, domestic violence seeing that growing up. So.
That's really interesting. And then can you tell us what Indigenous feminism means to you? I know it's a very broad question.
Okay, so what does it mean to me? For me, as I said, my kind of academic journey and personal journey was intertwined around thinking about why forms of gender violence were so pervasive, whether it was overt violence that was, physical or sexual assault, or just the everyday violences that you experience as a woman, and thinking about wanting that to change and be different and have people feel safe in their bodies or gender identity. And academically, searching that out, trying to figure out what is Indigenous feminism was actually kind of something that I'm still kind of thinking about. And as I said before, I don't like to define it because I think it always has to be attended to on the ground issues. And so it's going to look different at any given context, even for me in my own life. So right now I have a sense of it as a professor and an academic that Indigenous feminism is this kind of scholarship that's looking at these issues of violence and gender violence. But in terms of activists or personal experience, you know, it's a justice issue. And again, it's still kind of wrapped up in thinking about, you know, wanting the women that I know and love to be safe and to be like accepted in any way they express themselves.
Yeah. And then can you tell us a little bit about your research?
My research, I'm like laughing at all the stuff. My research is varied. And I think if you look at my little blurb on the FNIS website, it says something about Native women's intellectual traditions. And I think originally that was kind of my focus because I really wanted to excavate what are Native women's critiques of gendered colonialism? And that's outside of even the ways that we think about a feminist historiography or frame. So I'm really interested in early writers like Zakala Shaw or women who are writing at the, you know, in the 1800s or the turn of the, or in the 20th century, at the turn of the 20th century, for, you know, finding those kernels and stories of their experience and the ways that they understood colonialism to be gendered in a particular way towards them. So that's one part of it, and that's more of a historical project. The other part of it is really just the more contemporary and fun stuff that I like to think about and write about and look for are the ways that different forms of art making are attempting these same kinds of critiques. And so thinking about media artists or, you know, visual artists, which I'm so not trained in, but I've become so excited about the ways that people like filmmakers like Maya Telfeathers or others are producing work that is so sophisticated in its critique and analysis that I see my research as holding those people up. So yeah. I often think of myself as a bit of a fraud because I'm like, I don't really do anything cool. I just point out cool people doing cool stuff.
Which is cool because not that most people don't do that. How are people ever going to find out about cool people doing cool things?
Yeah, well, like, I hope that's a good contribution. But but yeah, that's kind of the way I think about my research. So thinking about feminist art and practice, either contemporarily or finding these early voices that, you know, offered a critique.
That's really interesting. And then can you tell us about some of your favorite publications that you have done?
Me?
Yeah.
haven't published a lot.
I looked up your bio on the FNIS website, and there were, like, three really cool ones. And I was like, wow.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's one that most students are familiar with because they teach it a lot in the FNIS courses. Because it's one that's probably the most accessible, but I have an article called We Hold Our Hands Up. And that piece was published online in the Decolonization Journal, but it was also published in The Winter We Danced, which was a collection of writings around Idle No More that was put together by Leanne Simpson and some others. And that piece is interesting to me because students seem to really like it. And I mean, I like it too. it's my work. But it's an interesting piece because for me, it was a difficult exercise to write. So I wrote that piece originally as a speech for an Idle No More teach-in. And the question that I was supposed to answer for that teach-in was, you know, can you give us a history of Indigenous women's activism in, you know, 10 minutes or less? And I was like, are you kidding me?
What?
No, I can't.
10 minutes?
But we each had, like, you know, a limited time to speak. And I was like, well, how do I even begin to talk about this? And of course, the reason why they wanted to speak around women's resistance history was because of the way that women shaped the Idle No More movement, thinking about Chief Spence Fast and also the women who started the movement, the hashtag. And when I was writing that piece, at that time, there was a lot of backlash in the media, not only against Idle No More, but in particular against Chief Spence.
CITR and Discorder are hiring a new station manager. Just asking for a friend, but if I know someone who would be great for this position, how would they apply? Well, you can email Eleanor at volunteer@citr.ca or Hala at president@citr.ca if you have any questions, and the full job description is on the CITR and Discorder website. If your friend thinks they can handle all this, then they should send a resume and cover letter to Hala Bertrand at president@citr.ca by Friday, March 3rd.
Thank you. Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
You're listening to Unseated Airwaves. The time is 2:52, and thank you for tuning in. Thank you to our guests, Dory Nason and Crystal Fraser. We would like to thank our sponsors, NORAD Electric and Decolonizing Water. The next show that you'll hear is Cue It Up. My name is Autumn Schnell, and you're listening to Unseated Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM. And for one final song, we have Quantum Tangle. You're going to be listening to Tiny Hands. They're really good. Yeah, this is one of my favorites by them. Actually, you're going to be listening to Tiny Hands Reimagined. This is one of my favorite songs by them, so I hope you enjoy it.
What have you seen in your short, long life? Where did those tiny feet roam? All the things you have done on top of being a wife, a mother, a daughter, a home. What have you seen in your short, long life? What has your heart overcome? The traditional ways that are hidden away can be revived by the beat of a drum. What have you seen in your short, long life? What did those tiny hands do? Stretching, scraping, fixing and making, mending the skins that our souls fit within, stitching. Traditional ways that are hidden away can be revived by the beat of a drum. What have you seen in your short, long life? A witness to so many wrongs. Relocation, damnation, misinformation, summation, our nation still strong. Silence your voice. The stories they spun made you swallow your tongue, made you feel like it was your choice. Traditional ways that are here.